From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting this week from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. What a week. Is your head spinning? Is your anger boiling? Are your fears spiking? Well, if so, take a deep breath and let's talk. On this week's State of Belief, we're going to talk about the worst financial situation in our country's history, and as we attempt to move forward, how we face a deficit-sized amount of questions, some political, some economic, and some, yes, even moral. Let me ask you, what says more about the values of our country than how we handle our national economy? No, I'm not going to spend today listing the seven deadly sins of those on Wall Street. But as those in power dictate what will happen next, we find ourselves with many looming questions. And we're not going to be quiet about them. Questions for people of faith or people of no faith. For example, how do we handle this financial crisis? Do we allow a meltdown on Wall Street to take the largest toll on the most vulnerable members of our society? Those who might literally find themselves in the street? How did the practices of some account for a growing inequality that affects us all? And most importantly, how do we correct those practices without allowing the inequality between us to grow? We'll be joined shortly by a congresswoman who's devoted a large part of her career to advocating for a safety net for our poor, a safety net that we need now more than ever. And we'll speak with a leading theologian who tells us what role faith can play in our economy. But first, a look at another debate that's raging on Capitol Hill, one that doesn't concern bailouts but could affect the welfare of many American citizens. Late last week, FBI Director Robert Mueller appeared before the House and Senate Judiciary Committees to present a plan that would expand the powers of the FBI when investigating potential threats of terrorism. Now, I know you're thinking, here we go again, and you're right. The FBI claims the new guidelines are a necessary tool for national security. But those on the other side of the debate say these new powers would simply open the door to racial and ethnic and religious profiling. I'm joined now by Caroline Fredrickson of the American Civil Liberties Union. Caroline is director of the Washington Legislative Office for the ACLU. Caroline, welcome to State of Belief.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
As I understand this thing, the FBI wants to expand their investigative powers. And I have to say right up front, I read this smiling because this sounds like old stuff coming back
yeah.
to office. But how dramatic are the changes these people are proposing?
Well, it's pretty much a radical change. You know, it is, and it's just as you said, it's really hearkening back to the bad old days of the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover. After all the revelations came out in the 70s about the variety of bad things that the FBI had been up to, including doing surveillance of Martin Luther King and then trying to blackmail him, there were some strong controls put in place, but very important controls about what kind of investigative powers the FBI should really use. So there were these guidelines put in place by the Attorney General at the time, Attorney General Levy. And they basically said, you know, if you're going to investigate, you have to have some reason. You know, you can't just decide you're going to investigate somebody because you don't like the color of their skin, you don't like what their religion is, you don't like the fact that they looked at you cross-eyed. For whatever reason, you have to actually have some inkling that they're going to commit a crime or they have committed a crime.
So let me get this straight. An investigation could occur without evidence that an investigation needs to occur?
That's exactly right. What they basically said, and this is their own words, you don't need a factual predicate. So that is, you don't need any facts anymore. The FBI doesn't need any facts in order to start investigating. Say some group is having a meeting and they don't like the war in Iraq, or they don't like the president's policies on clean water or any number of other things. They want to have a meeting, and some FBI agents decides that, you know, he or she wants to investigate, they can start hiring paid informants. They can start, you know, staking out the meeting. They can actually pretend to be somebody else and go into the meeting and sit there and take notes. I mean, that is extremely troubling. It's troubling from several points of view. One is that there's this whole issue of the First Amendment and the right of people to actually talk about their political ideas and not be subject to FBI spying.
What was that, the First Amendment?
Yeah, I mean, that whole thing, you know, and the other piece of it is that I think, you know, people also recognize that this will rapidly open the door to racial, ethnic, and religious profiling. That is.
Now, I want you to talk about that, because our listeners are extremely interested in that, and specifically from the perspective of religious liberty. So tell us about that.
Well, you know, here's the thing, is that the driving force here, what the FBI says it needs this for, is because they explicitly do want to follow up on associations that they make, you know, basically, you know, guilt by associations that they make. In this era right now, after 9/11, they're focusing most on Arab Americans and on American Muslims. And so that means, for example, to quote from the FBI itself, they say Hezbollah, terrible terrorist organization, is based in Lebanon, right? That's made up of Lebanese people. That means that Lebanese Americans should be fair game, right? Because they're Lebanese, therefore they might be associated with Hezbollah. So when we say, well, that's not enough. You can't accuse every Lebanese American of being associated with Hezbollah. You couldn't accuse every Irish American of being associated with the IRA, nor could you accuse every Italian American of being associated with the Sicilian mob. I mean, that's just ludicrous, right? But so they want to open the door exactly to that guilt by association, using people's race, ethnicity, and religion as the basis for very intrusive FBI surveillance.
Now, my guess would be, and I will ask this since I'm a Christian, my guess would be that Christians don't have much to worry about here.
You know, it's not true, and I don't think anybody can sort of rest sleep easy at this point, because you also have to understand that in this administration, there have been certain denominations that have been actively involved against the war in Iraq. Quakers, for example, you know, they are pacifists and have had many meetings to describe, you know, to discuss their opposition to the war. They've actually been infiltrated by our government. They have been spied on. So Well, I think the focus is primarily right now on Muslims and people of Arab background. Nobody can count on not being the subject of some kind of surveillance, you know, because there is also this other part about what your political views are and whether you decide that you don't agree with this president on a certain number of issues like the war in Iraq or any number of things. And so I think there is that famous quotation from the minister in Germany when the Nazis took over, and I wish I could remember the whole thing, but it's basically, they came for the other person, they came for the other person, and then finally there was nobody to stand up for me, they came for me, right? I mean, that's ultimately
Martin
the position
Niebuhr.
We're in. We don't protect the rights of other people to be free from completely unsubstantiated surveillance, you know, the FBI deciding they just don't like the color of your skin or the color of your eyes, you know, that there's no reason to think that we won't be the subject of this kind of surveillance next.
It's a very good point.
You know, obviously, all is not lost. This is something that if we are organized and we bring it to people's attention and we let them know about the dangers that are inherent in unfettered power for this law enforcement agency to spy on Americans without any facts, you know, this is a very dangerous path for our country to go down. We've gone down it before. We know what the dangers are. We know what the bad outcomes are. And so we've got to put a stop to it as quickly as we can. And so that means people need to get engaged. They need to call their members of Congress. And, you know, they can call the Justice Department and tell them, you know, this is completely wrong. But I think the most appropriate way to go is to let your member of Congress know before the election, hopefully, these guidelines stink and need to be repealed.
Caroline Fredrickson is director of the Washington Legislative Office for the ACLU. Caroline, thanks for the work that you do, and I appreciate you being with us on State of Belief.
Oh, well, it's such a pleasure to be with you.
Coming up on State of Belief, the moral questions of an economic meltdown. I'll be joined shortly by a member of Congress to talk about the obligations of government. And we'll talk about faith and the economy. And it's a little different than faith in the economy. Who has that anymore? Find out more when we come back. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty. On today's show, it's the economy, friends. Less than a few weeks ago, it seemed as if this election could once again become dominated by the so-called culture wars, issues like abortion or gay marriage, and that's it. Yes, it's hard to imagine, but I can remember hearing pundits make that very prediction. Well, with the financial events of the past week, we're in a whole new ball game. We may even be in a whole new ballpark. But I ask you, although the national conversation now focuses solely on the economy, aren't we still talking about morals? Doesn't an economic crisis challenge our very core values, raising questions like our country's response to growing poverty and inequality? And as our leaders debate the fate of financial institutions, what is the government's responsibility to the Americans most in need, particularly as economic hardships increase for everyone? I'm joined now by Congressman Rosa DeLauro. Rosa DeLauro is currently serving her 9th term in Congress, representing the 3rd District of Connecticut. She sits on the House Appropriations and Budget Committees, and she's made economic improvement a top priority during her distinguished tenure in the United States Congress. Representative DeLauro, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you.
From your perspective, what are some of the moral implications facing our government right now in the midst of this crisis?
Well, first of all, I am a believer that there is a connection between public service and the whatever faith people bring to their service in government, that faith informs a public policy. I think one would have to say today that certainly you're taking a look at how the economy and what we do with public policy as it relates to the economy is indicative or a reflection of your values. Mm-hmm. I mean, about extending unemployment insurance today. You have long-term unemployment, which is on the rise. You know, I view that as a moral issue of our extending the unemployment benefits for people whose benefits have, expired. Again, given today's economy, we see that the soup kitchens are more and more being visited by people, because in fact in this nation what we have are people and children who are going hungry. That, in my view, is a moral issue, and there is a moral responsibility of government to engage in these areas. Low-income energy assistance for heating. Mm-hmm. I come from the Northeast, a cold winter. Again, the cost of home heating oil, gasoline. Some people in my part of the country are going to freeze. Government needs to be there in order to assist people with challenges in their lives that are overwhelming. No one believes that government can do everything, but these are issues we have to engage in and look to dealing with responsible public policy that assists people in meeting these challenges.
Representative DeLauro, I know that we need to be looking ahead, but I can't help but ask you, given your sensitivity to the moral issues here, how much of the situation that we're in now is a product of some bad moral decision making?
Oh, if you're talking specifically about the financial crisis,
yes,
that you know that we are in today,
yes,
which is really putting families at risk. Look, there isn't any question with the subprime mortgage crisis that there were some people who were not going to be able to afford to be in their own home. As much of the American dream is everyone's dream, but there's also clear fact about predatory lending. Because what we have seen as a result of these kinds of policies, we have seen the greed of some of these corporations and companies that where people made millions and millions of dollars at the expense of folks who essentially wanted the opportunity to be able to own their own home.
Mm-hmm.
My view is the people who have a first call on how we address these this financial crisis are, you know, middle-class families in this country who find themselves in deepening economic straits, and nobody's looking for a handout or something, but allow them to, you know, through bankruptcy judges, et cetera, to renegotiate these mortgages, to address solving the problem as well as allowing people to stay in their homes.
Congressman DeLauro, let me ask you this. Let's say that you're given a situation where you're in the room with Barack Obama and John McCain alone, and they tell you you've got a minute and a half to tell us what the most important priorities in the first days of our term, whichever one of us wins. What are those priorities?
Mm-hmm. I think what we need to do is to turn this economy around, make it work for middle-class families in this country, make it work for everyone in this country, provide real opportunity. We look at jobs, we look at health care, making it accessible and affordable. And I would just say to you, because it's such a looming issue, I think we have to take a look at how we responsibly redeploy from Iraq and bring our young men and women back home.
Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro is currently serving her ninth term in Congress, representing the 3rd District of Connecticut. You've always been accessible to us, and we appreciate that. Thanks for your time today.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And don't you go away. Coming up on State of Belief, more on morality and the economy. We'll be right back. Hello again, everybody. I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief. For those of you who are just joining us, we're talking today about morality and the economy. And if any of you are having a hard time seeing what role faith plays in wading through economic hardship, let me ask you a question. Whether you're a religious person or not, are there not some basic moral questions that need to be answered now that we face a meltdown on Wall Street that surely will leak into houses across America? Joining me now to help answer some of these questions is Susan Brooks Thistlewaite. Susan is a professor of theology at Chicago Theological Seminary, where she recently also served as president. She often writes about economics and religion in her posts for the blog On Faith, co-sponsored by Newsweek and The Washington Post. Susan, welcome to State of Belief.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
I actually should say welcome back, because you've been on this program before in very helpful ways.
Well, I appreciate it.
Now, this isn't going to be the toughest question you ever get. In fact, I would consider this, knowing you, a softball question. Why is the economy an issue of faith?
Well, I think that the Bible shows us that God does have an economics, and that economics is fairness, not necessarily equality. And I think people sometimes get those confused. But as Christians, we believe that this is God's creation, and this creation we have stewardship over, as it says in Genesis.
Now, what does stewardship mean?
Well, that's where we need to take that seriously. We need to make sure that God's creation is cared for in the environment, but also that the people and the creatures have access, not necessarily always precisely equal access, but fairness. And I think in this time of crisis, a lot of people are turning back to the Bible, not only for this basic question of fairness, but also to ask themselves, what went wrong?
What do you think went wrong?
I think greed and sin is what went wrong, not just individually, but I think, and this is a failure, I think, of conservative theology. It's not just individuals or a few bad apples. This is a system that is set up to reward greed. And I think one of the things we are also seeing is greed is not only wrong, it's not only morally wrong, but it doesn't work. It actually doesn't get the system to work properly, and you get excessive greed, as we currently have, and it comes crashing down.
I hate to tell you this, but you're probably never going to be a chaplain on Wall Street.
I think that's probably right. Well, I think that's probably right. Well, but on the other hand, if these people keep going down the road that they're going, my husband and I were talking last night, well, we're going to have to work till we're 80 because we're never going to be able to retire. So I'm not pleased with them right now, as I think the majority of Americans are not pleased with their bad stewardship.
Susan, let's look at the positive side of things. What does a morally fair economy or a morally responsible economy look like?
Well, I think it is an economy that produces jobs and does not outsource them. I think it is an economy that pays a fair wage, and I think listeners know that the minimum wage has not in any way kept pace with inflation. And that we are seeing is what failed over the last 8 years, is that we had not a creation of jobs, but actually fewer and fewer jobs and lower paying jobs. So people were working twice as hard for less. They were tempted, and I use that word deliberately, into high interest credit cards to make up the difference, mm-hmm. tempted into low interest mortgages, which they really couldn't afford, or if they lost their job, they went bankrupt. So God's economy is an economy that works to get people to participate in it if they are willing to work. And I think that, you know, that's the good news, as you're saying. The good news is we know how to do this, mm-hmm. and we know that the market is a powerful, powerful tool, but if it is not regulated, it can run out of control like this.
I know that in one of your recent posts on the blog On Faith, you wrote specifically about a Christian view that could be applied to the economy, drawing from the idea of Jesus preaching specifically about the poor and improving the plight of the poor. Our program, State of Belief, appeals to people from a variety of religions, and with a lot of people coming to listen to us with no association with organized religion. So let's push that a little bit. We're basically talking about not just a uniquely Christian point of view, aren't we, but basic moral principles that apply regardless of religion.
Yes, I think that's exactly right, Welton. And I think that all the world's major religions
come out very strongly on the need to care for the least of these. You'll find that in Islam, you'll find it in Judaism, you find it in Protestant Christianity, Catholic Christianity, and across the world's religions. But what I want to say is that many people often see that simply as charity, but if you look at what happens to an economy when it works for most of the people, and it works from the bottom up, is that it's a very productive and energetic economy and produces a lot of goods and services. But I want people to come away with the idea that what in their humanist or religious belief is take care of those who have less, I want them to try to make the connection to the fact that actually that's a better and more productive economy than when just a couple of people are rich at the top and everybody else is poor.
Got to ask you one other question, because the distinction here is an extremely important one. You know me well enough to know that I advise houses of worship and their leaders not to endorse partisan campaigns from the pulpit. And I tread very lightly on saying, let's try to move from your moral understanding on this issue to an act of legislation that imposes that understanding on the nation. Why do you think it's okay to take the issue of stewardship and fairness from a particular religious perspective and say this ought to be the prevailing view in our land?
Well, I wouldn't make the equation quite that close. I think our job as religious leaders, and I've never heard anybody do this any better than William Sloan Coffin, when he and I and many other religious leaders went to Washington after Ronald Reagan was first elected, and we were lobbying against all these cuts in social programs that were just hitting the poor so hard. And a few people were invited, not me, but William Sloan Coffin, to meet with President Reagan in the Oval Office. And President Reagan, according to Bill Coffin, was explaining why, to balance the budget, they had to make all these social cuts. And Bill Coffin said, Mr. President, it's up to us as religious leaders to proclaim that justice shall roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Your job is the plumbing. And so I don't want to dictate to the Congress how they should do this, but I am going, as a religious leader and any person of faith, any person who considers themselves a moral person of conscience, should hold this country accountable for how it has not produced the plumbing. This doesn't work. It isn't working. And there's even rhetoric about how our monetary supply, you know, is clogged. So that fits the metaphor. But this is terrible plumbing. These people are plumbers that we should fire, because they're not getting the waters of righteousness to people. And there's nothing more concrete than, can you feed your family? Have you got a roof over your head? Can you take your kids to the doctor if they're sick? That's morality. And anybody who tells us differently is talking baloney, I think.
I'm not telling you differently, but mm-hmm. I'm telling you what, you're really something else. Susan Brooks Thistlewaite is a professor of theology at Chicago Theological Seminary. I'm delighted to say that she is a good friend, and I hope you keep on doing what you're doing, Susan. Thank you.
Well, the same to you, Welton, because your show is very important to get these people to discuss things and think about them.
Well, thanks for being on it again, and we will see you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief. We got to take a quick break, though, right now, so please don't go anywhere. I'd like to share some of my thoughts with you in a very special preaching to the choir segment. Stay tuned. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty. And friends, what a week we've had. Turmoil in the economy, turmoil in the election. When I look back at this week, I have a hard time describing exactly what I am feeling. But I'd like to share some thoughts in a special segment that we call Preaching to the Choir.
Amen, 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 with the horns now.
What is this feeling of heaviness that seems to be covering the nation like a heavy blanket? Do you feel it? Maybe not. I hope not, actually, but I do. That question has bothered me enough to prompt a bit of inventory. What's going on that could edge a whole nation toward a bit of psychic depression? Well, there is this "the sky is falling" rhetoric about an economic crisis. A man accustomed to making $30 million or so a year is asking those of us who have trouble getting our minds around $50,000 a year just to trust him. Trust him with our modest retirement plans and in advance absolve him of any errors or illegalities he may commit. Gosh, could we get a deal like that for ourselves, including an advance on no penalties for bad judgments or outright mistakes? Now look, let's get this straight. We're being asked to pay $700 billion to save institutions that made bad decisions motivated by a pervasive greed, and to give those trying to fix the problems a pass if they misuse our money or if they make the situation worse. But this isn't merely a theoretical strategy for political debate. This is an administration that rushed us into a needless war and unavoidable deaths, asking us to trust them again when they say we need to move quickly. And this is a Congress, a body of legislators that the public doesn't trust, debating what to do with our money. Be specific here. Our pittances in saving accounts, our 401ks and other retirement plans for which we have no backups and no national body to restore in our accounts what gets lost. Quickly getting enough of economic theories and disturbing figures, my mind turns to Nicholas Kristof's suggestion last week that race is a problem of proportions in this election to which the public has not yet turned its attention. More depression, really. Most devastating to people who care about religion is the columnist's suggestion that the electorate is hiding deeply seated racial prejudice under the guise and in the language of religion. Goodness, have we come no further than that? To deny a person an office on the basis of race is only a short extension of our nation's sick denial of a person's right to vote on the basis of race. But what if it really is about religion? Doesn't make me feel any better. A scurrilous email has made the rounds charging that Barack Obama's a Muslim, and not so subtly suggesting that being a Muslim is a deal breaker, the ultimate disqualifier in politics. Though our Constitution forbids a religious test for public office. By the way, where are all of the constitutional purists on this issue? How do you explain the silence on this matter from those who want to change the Constitution while telling us that they are really trying to preserve the original intent of those who wrote it? And have you seen this film called Obsession? It's being mailed to people in swing states in the presidential election. A group called the Clarion Fund is funding the distribution of the DVD. It's difficult to find out anything about this fund, to tell you the truth, but we do know one thing. They're rich. They're distributing 28 million copies of the video that leaves the impression that all Muslims are associated with what's commonly referred to as radical Islamic terrorism. I just wonder, why not call it radical political terrorism? That's what the source of the dastardly deeds is called when no association with Islam is claimed truthfully or manipulatively. But you know what? I got to stop this. Trying to discover the sources of this growing feeling of depression, frankly, is making me feel worse, not better. And I haven't even mentioned the great distraction of the moment, a candidate for the vice presidency of the nation, whose qualifications for that office many Americans still question. How could this be? Why will the McCain campaign not give reporters access to Governor Palin so that we can better understand her positions on the very real challenges facing this nation? How will we know if she's prepared to be vice president, much less president, unless she's subjected to the same scrutiny that all other candidates for high office must face? Look, Sarah Palin could be exactly what America needs, for all I know. But without an open dialogue in which her positions can be known and evaluated and challenged, we will never know. Or worse, we may not find out until she takes office. One thing I do know, a single but vital part of the solution to dealing with a growing depression or mounting frustration or anger simmering at a level on the verge of explosion is to do something. Something positive. Act. Do something that even ever so slightly is a correction to the problem or problems that are making us sick. I think I'll go now. And I think I'll work on that. Why don't you work on it also? A contribution to a solution to something. Well, that's our show for this week. Remember to share your thoughts about the show by going to stateofbelief.com and clicking on the Contact Us page. And as always, we must remind you that State of Belief is produced by Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, which means this show is supported by members of Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. And while you're there, please think about becoming more than a listener. Become a member of Interfaith Alliance. Your membership can help keep State of Belief on the air. Make sure now to tune in next week. Things are happening so fast and furiously, there's always something interesting to talk about. And until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief. Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.